Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, dear listener. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Guitar Nerds Podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by the 40 Watt Podcast's Philip Carter.
Hello there.
Hello there. Hello, Philip. Hello, dear listener. Welcome back. We're crashing through season 5. We're up to episode 12. I've got 12. My camera in front of my screen. I'm sort of looking around. It is terrible. This episode is called Nashville, the Endgame and 1960s Gibsons, because those are kind of the things I want to talk about. I wanted to talk about the sound sample this week. We're going to talk about the KMA Endgame, this pedal, because I'm a big fan of it. It's very cool, very interesting, and it's taken me a while to sort of get my head around it and all the features and make the most of it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Of course, we have Philip Carter here. Philip's just been to the Nashville Guitar Festival, so we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the inevitable wealth of purchases that Philip has made over the last little while. Yes, that's left his gear fund completely depleted for the immediate future until he sells a few things. So we're going to be talking about some of those things. And, you know, of course, I think both Philip and I have some custom guitars on order, which we're probably going to be talking about as well. So a bit of boutique guitar chatter from some of the best of America's luthiers. And yeah, a little bit of effects pedal, a little bit more guitar show. It is wall-to-wall guitar shows for the start of 2024.
Yeah, we're in 24. So
yes, that one.
So the Nashville show was... Oh, by the way, I'm going to stop before. Nashville, the Endgame sounds like an apocalyptic video game I didn't know I needed. I'm just saying, someone please make that game.
Right.
Because I want to see a complete like wasteland of Broadway and Second Avenue. It's just... Yeah. I think it'll look great.
But the
Nashville Guitar Show was my first ever guitar show.
Wait,
I've
what?
I've never been to a guitar show. That was the first time ever.
Right.
I've played guitar for 25 years, and I've never been to a guitar show.
Wow, I am shocked at that fact. I mean, is probably good for you, considering how susceptible you are to making new purchases. I would say a guitar show is a place where you're inevitably going to spend an awful lot of dosh.
As I did. luckily, I went into it knowing I was spending some money. So,
right. So
like,
you took,
I knew what I was getting into.
Show money with you, which is always the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. That can be a little bit double-edged sometimes. I've been at a couple of guitar shows where I've been so excited to spend money and I haven't really found anything there that I wanted to, but I'd worked myself up into a frenzy about it and ended up buying some pretty average things because of it.
Right. It's stuff you didn't intend to get. I went with a very, very specific purpose and did not actually meet that goal. But that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is the Nashville Guitar Show as a type of show? Is it all vintage gear? Is it new brands showing stuff off? Is it luthiers and boutique things?
It's the Amigo, officially it's the Amigo Guitar Shows. And right. So Amigo does a run of guitar shows across the country. In LA, Anaheim, back in January, at the same weekend as NAMM, actually, they had the Amigo Guitar Show Costa Mesa. So they're in Anaheim, Costa Mesa area. They had a guitar show that coincided with NAMM, same company, same, you know, organizer. And so this is the Nashville area. It's technically in Franklin, and it's not in Nashville. It's like 20, 30 minutes out of Nashville.
Right.
At an Ag Expo Center. That's really easy to forget that it's actually a dirt floor you're walking around on because they cover it. You know, it's covered, but then you get to one section that's completely unlevel. And so you're like, oh yeah, this is a dirt floor. This is like the same place they have like cattle shows and rodeos and stuff like that.
Wow, that is the most American place ever for a guitar show.
It really is. It really, really is. So it is, at least this one, I can't speak for all of them, but this one in Nashville was predominantly vintage dealers. I have never been in a room with so many vintage Gibsons and Fender guitars and other brands, obviously, but there was definitely a strong Gibson Fender presence at this guitar show, probably much more so Gibson. I've never seen so many vintage Gibson guitars in one place in my entire life.
Gretchen Rickenbacker as well. Was it sort of just a...
Here and there for those brands, but it was predominantly – and also I think Gibson is what I was hunting. So,
right.
So I saw a lot more of that. Yeah. I saw a lot of Fenders, though. There were a lot of vintage – there was a just cherry 51 Telecaster that I didn't even look for a price tag because there's no world in which I can afford that. There was a 57 Gold Top – all original there that had a $134,000 price tag. I'm not used to seeing the Gold Tops in that range, but that's where they are now, I guess.
Wow, that is a lot of money.
It really, really is. Saw some really, really rad things like the Jerry Jones double neck bass and guitar, the Dan Electro double neck.
Oh,
yeah. Oh. It was $7,500.
Really? That much now? Yes. Oh, was it in copper?
It was like a copper burst without pulling up the picture. It looked great. It absolutely looked phenomenal.
So good. I think the bass side of that only has like 14 frets or something. It's an extremely short scale.
It was the first time I'd seen one in person. So I didn't even know what to expect seeing it. There was a lot of first time I've ever seen this in person at that show. So I went specifically hunting. So I originally wasn't going to this guitar show. I wanted to, but you know, life and staying busy and whatnot. But I was playing guitar for a high school show choir. I'd been hired to play this, and I've been playing all season. Show choir is a big deal in parts of our country, it's like Glee, but way grittier because they only show you the fancy parts on Glee. I've never seen an episode of Glee, so I actually don't know. Dear listeners, if you've seen Glee, then yes, it's similar from what I understand. But we were playing for the National Show Choir competition in Nashville at the Opry House. Right. And so I got to play a couple of times on that stage. We finished second, which is great.
Congratulations.
Yeah, those kids are incredible. Those kids are great singers. They're great performers. They work very, very, very hard, and it showed. But I got to play a lot of guitar in that show. It's the first show choir I've ever played for, where they told me to turn up. they actually want to know that the guitar is there, which is
great. That's great. What guitar did you bring for that? Or did you bring a selection?
I took the PRS. I took my PRS single cut trim. The reason I took that one is because it's got the coil split. It's got a good coil split on
versatility.
It.
Versatility.
Yes. It came down to versatility because the songs we were playing in this show, now they're all adapted and arranged. So you're not going to hear them exactly as they are, right? But we did everything from like Uptown Funk is in this show. Lenny Kravitz is in this show. I can't remember the name of the song. Then we're playing Shake It Off by Taylor Swift, and then we close on Freebird. So it's like I needed a little of everything.
Fair enough.
So I took my pedal board with the Chase Bliss automaton pedals, the overdrive and the reverb, and it had the HX effects on it, and I run a live amp. We don't run in-ears. We play live. Wow. Drummer. It's a big 10-piece band.
I'm surprised for a choir to set things up in that way. Yeah. What amplifier did you bring in that case?
For finals, I took a Sur Bella reverb combo.
Right.
I needed a good clean sound with reverb and put it on the 22-watt mode, turned it up. It was great. It was perfect. We mic it.
Wicked. I'm not really familiar with that amplifier at all. 112?
So it is a 112. They also offer it as a head. So the Bella reverb is that... There's a lot of videos out there, listeners. You can go watch a bunch of great stuff. I highly recommend the John Nathan Cordy video on it. It's really good. But essentially, the DNA of this amp is it is that middle between a like clean Dumble circuit and a Fender circuit. You know how Dumble was essentially hot rodded Fenders? This one lands somewhere in the middle of those things. It's got a little bit of both.
I see.
It sounds killer. It sounds absolutely monstrous. I got it recently, so I'll edge into what I was doing at the guitar show. So the national show choirs for finals happened to be the same weekend as the guitar show. So I was already in Nashville.
This worked out very well.
Exactly. It worked out perfectly. So I sold a bunch of stuff, Joe. I sold like $3,000 worth of pedals. I sold a big amp. I sold a bunch of stuff.
In anticipation of going to the Nashville show.
Going to this Nashville show. I wanted money in hand to be able to, because I knew what I wanted. I was hunting a 50s Gibson. Of some kind.
I remember telling me that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never have like 50s Les Paul money. I'll never have 50s 335, 345, 355 money.
But so there's you're a looking lot for of, a random ES, basically.
Yeah, exactly. A 125, 225, 150, something like that. And so I was hunting that and I didn't buy that.
Why did you want one of those though? Before we talk about what you bought, why were you going after like a 125? Was it or something of that? Was it because you wanted a vintage 335 but couldn't stretch to it? Was that the aim for it? You wanted that thin hollow body Gibson tone?
Sort of. I did specifically want a hollow body, not a semi-hollow. So
and obviously
the first Gibson semi-hollow is the 335 in 1958. And I have over my shoulder here a 1958 reissue 335. And I love that guitar. I'll never be able to afford a vintage 58 or 59 335.
What do they go for? I don't even keep track of.
Let's see what a quick Google search while I'm thinking about this. We'll look at 58 Gibson ES335 and see if it'll give me something that's not a...
Yeah, reissue. Yeah.
So that's a reissue. I see one on Reverb. There's a 58 ES335 PD for $55,000.
Ugh. Yeah.
That's not happening.
£55,000, dear listener. Well, that is a lot of money. Considering it was very hard to even do a Google search then because it's such a heavily reissued instrument and made very well as well.
So I've got one. Actually, mine is from the same run as Mick from that Pedal Show's 58 reissue. His is in natural, but mine's a burst.
Very nice. What year?
I think mine's a 14, maybe it's somewhere. I can never remember.
2014 was good times. 2014 was that anniversary year, wasn't it? And the problem with that year was all the standard models had that terrible 12th fret logo that said 120 years of Gibson.
I hated it.
It was bad. It was a bad little logo. But around that time, Gibson were making their best stuff because, of course, we all know, dear listener, a year later in 2015 came Robot Tears. And it was a mess from that point on. But anyway, sorry, we're digressing. So
no,
So
it's what we do. It's what we do. Of course. We digress. So, but yeah, I was hunting that. I love this 335. 335 is me in a guitar, just period. A little oversized, a little cumbersome, and just what we are. So that's just who I am as a guitar. But it's the blues and the love of a jazz in me that I wanted a hollow body. I've always wanted a 175. We talked about this when you sold your 175. When I bought my Novo, my first Novo, the first boutique guitar I've ever owned, it was a 40th birthday guitar for me. And I had actually saved up money to buy a 40th birthday guitar, but I was actually hunting a 175.
Right.
And I ended up getting the Novo instead. So I was looking for a 50s Gibson hollow body of some kind. I wasn't even 100% sold on it being having a pickup. Like, if I'd found a really great arch top, and I did, I found a couple really great arch top acoustics that were absolutely
killer.
They are
tons of money. Like an arch top pickupless Gibson must be comparatively $10,000.
They don't sell for that. That's wild. They don't. But because it's not a J45, it's not an LGO, it's not, you know, it's not those sought after models. It's an arch top F hold acoustic, and a lot of people just don't go for them. It's wild, but that is what it is. I mean, Gibson really, they had a lot of acoustic guitars previously, and the LGO and the LG1, of course, are famous. A lot of blues guys played them. Of course, Robert Johnson pictured with his is a big deal. Yeah. But when you get into those arch topped ones, by the time you get an arch top, a lot of players are like, oh, I want an electric because I'm playing jazz or something like that. So I got lucky though. And literally the first booth I walked into, the very first booth I saw, had this 1965 ES-125 CD. So talk about the letters at the end of these. So the 125, if you just get a Gibson ES-125, it is a fully hollow, full, like 3.5-4 inch thick body with a P90 in the neck and no cutaway. And that's it.
Right. Oh,
so the letters are what tell you how it differentiates from that baseline. So if it has a C, it means it has a cutaway and it's a Florentine cutaway. If it has a D, it means it is a dual pickup model. So it has two pickups rather than one. And if it has a T, it means it is the thin line version of that model rather than the full body. So I found a 125 CD. So cutaway, dual pickup, but the full size, just it's a 175. That's just it's a not so fancy 175.
Right. So so the inlays are different, I guess, on a 125. It's just dot.
Just dots. It's a silkscreen logo. I'm holding it for the viewers that may see this over on YouTube or wherever you happen to see it. 50s Gibson P90s. Now, depending on the model you get, some of them had a floating wood bridge. Right. Some of them had a floating bridge with an ABR1 tunematic on it. And some of them still, and I think this is the fewest of them, actually has a top-mounted tunomatic with a block underneath it to support it.
Ooh, wow. Okay.
I don't see those so often.
No, I feel like you've got the best option there out of those.
Yeah, I agree. And so I played that instrument. He had nines on it, which, for the love of God, why would you do that?
It's not for you. Just get a Strat. Like, if nines are your vibe, that's totally fine. Don't ruin a good arch top with a set of nines.
But, you know, looking over it, tuners were original. Pickups were original. It looks like the Strat pegs, one of them has been replaced and one of them has not. Either that or it's the cleanest neck Strat peg I've ever seen.
Right.
The finish is great.
Would they even had a Strat button where it's got a Strat button?
I think they do.
Really?
They do.
Oh, okay. 175s didn't.
Well, No, they didn't. And this, but this is also 1965. So oh, okay. The 335's already come out by this point. The Les Paul has come out and gone by this point. and the SG is out at this point in Gibson's time period. So in a 50s version, it may not have had a strap button. But by 65, yes, it had a strap button. Nut is original. I mean, it's all original. All original electronics. It's got an original. I'm sorry, Joe. This isn't vegan, but I didn't hurt this turtle. Has an actual tortoiseshell pick guard.
It's a very good looking pick guard.
It really is.
At that time, it would have been hide glue as well. So super not
hide
vegan.
Glue. Also, Brazilian rosewood fingerboard. Wow. So it's not quite a thin taper neck. But it is not the chunky of the 50s. Right, so some of these jazz voicings are a little easier. You know, I'm
able
to get.
Do you prefer that, the thin one?
I typically prefer the chunky 58, early 59 neck. But if I'm going to play jazz on it, which is what I'm trying to do, play more jazz on it, I want something where I can get some of the more complicated voicings without stressing my hand out. And this is perfect. At first, I thought the neck was too narrow. But then when I put the new bridge on it, I ordered a wood bridge to replace the ABR1 because the ABR1 saddles were just pitted. Like they were just too low. They were buzzing out. And when I reset the strings, I realized, oh, it's not the neck is too narrow. It's the string spacing when they notched the ABR1 was too narrow. So I was able to stretch the strings out to a better spacing. And now it's perfect.
Still okay over the pickups and everything. I mean, I guess that's what I
used to line it up. I just lined it back up over the pickup to where they should be. They were too narrow before. Uh-huh. But I'm absolutely in love with this guitar.
Are you going to make any other changes to it?
No, I won't change anything else to it. The only thing I might consider doing is putting strap locks on it if I'm going to gig it standing up. That's it. That's the only thing I would do.
fine, sure.
But it's just got this beautiful maple top and back.
It's a fantastic looking guitar. Dear listener, you know, check out the YouTube just so you can see it. Or obviously just, you know, Philip posted about it on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook. Philip's posted about it on his own social media on the 40 Watt Podcast social media. Go and check out this guitar. The finish is really great. We were speaking about it, you know, just after you bought it. I absolutely love the finish. You would have preferred something that was a bit more of a sunburst. What do you call the finish that's on there?
I would call this a faded cherry sunburst.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
So instead of going to red on the edges, it really goes to sort of a dark orange or, you know, a burnt orange kind on the edges. I would have preferred it to go to like a black or like a close to black on the edges. That's just the way I like guitars.
It's got that sort of Sienna burst style thing to it. Which,
exactly.
I can get behind. I think it's not tomato soup. Better aged. No, exactly.
Yeah, it's not tomato soup. It's not clown burst. It looks good.
And it's good.
I normally hate cherry burst. So.
Well, it's not my favorite, but it's the aging. It's not so much lacquer checking as the fading, the natural fading of the finish, the lack of any gloss being left on it. It's you know, it's just a bit more naturally scratched up and worn, not physical scratch. I'm not describing that very well, dear listener, but it's the fact that it's been around for virtually an entire lifetime. And it just seems to have settled really well. It just looks fantastic. Such incredible, incredible condition for its age. Guitar Nerds is sponsored by Stringjoy Guitar Strings, the world's first true guitar string custom shop. The thing that I love most about Stringjoy is just their attention to detail, their dedication to making their strings the best in the world. And that's a labor-intensive task that they don't shy away from. Stringjoy are also innovative. They're always looking for new ways to make strings better. As guitar players, we've become so used to all the shortfalls of commercially available strings that we stopped even looking for them to be better, last longer, intonate well, easily. Stringjoy bring all of that to every pack of strings they make, and they're available almost as readily as any other generically made guitar string. Stringjoy strings are available at stringjoy.com and at 400 plus dealers across the globe. If your local store doesn't stock Stringjoy yet, ask them to.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, there were some great 50s Gibsons that I looked at that were maybe just a hair cheaper than this one because of its condition, because of the loadout is a desirable loadout. Yeah. The guy cut me an okay deal on it. He didn't come down as much as I wanted him to, but he did come down. It's just incredible. And so I saw it in the first booth I walked into, and then I walked the entire show because I was not going to buy the first thing I saw.
Sure.
I walked the entire show and came back to it. Because I was like, no, that's the one. That's it.
Was it a big show? How long did it take to walk around the whole thing?
It probably took me. I did put a video up over on my Instagram where you can sort of see if for listeners that are familiar with American Expo pavilions and parks where they do these kinds of cattle shows, you'll have an idea how big it is. I'd say the floor of it. Actually, I can put this in a good relation. It's about the size of a soccer pitch in a soccer stadium.
Oh, right. Okay. Fine. Yeah.
Or football, as you prefer, or you know, whatever you want to call it.
I only recently learned that you guys are correct that is the original name for that it. It was
soccer is the British word for it because it was originally football. And then when it split between rugby football and association football, which is soccer as we know it, it got shortened to people would say ASOC football. And then they would just say ASOC. And then it got called soccer. And that's the British pronunciation of it. So when it came over to the US, we called rugby football and soccer soccer. And then when American football was developed, it was just called football and rugby just called rugby.
Yeah, there you go. How about that? But we do all know the size of a soccer pitch, so that's good. That's a good way to judge it. Okay, so you walked around the whole thing. You came back to it. I wonder the condition of it's so good, and I was just thinking about like sort of the poor condition of a lot of vintage Fenders and a lot of vintage Gibsons when it's SGs or Les Pauls. And I was thinking, actually, a guitar that's not used for rock and roll or punk rock is so much more likely to be in great condition. That's actually, this is great. If you want a vintage guitar, dear listener, maybe just go for something jazzy. Something that's not been used ever by punk rock would be very advantageous.
So I had this friend of mine, he used to go by, I don't know if he still uses this moniker anymore, but he was a blues singer from the Northeast. He came to live in my hometown for a little while to absorb sort of the blues culture of the Mississippi Delta. Eli Paperboy Reed, if you've not heard of him, you need to check him out. The guy's incredible. I only really know him as, I know his last name, but I can't think of it right now. I've only ever called him Eli Reed. But he told me back in the early 2000s, late 90s, he said, if you want a vintage Gibson at a good price, buy an ES-125. He told me back then you could get them for $900, $800. and then they kept going up and I still thought about this and I'm like, man, I really need to. And I kept putting it off. And now if you want a 50s ES-125 in good shape, depending on the spec, like if you get the no cutaway with just the neck pickup, you can get them much cheaper. But
oh, really? I would have thought James Bay would have ruined the price of those.
You would have thought, but it's not an Epiphone Century, so they didn't completely ruin it. To give you an idea, an ES-125, we'll see what I can pull up very quickly on Reverb. We're going to sort low to high, see if we can find a good condition one. Here is a full-bodied 1950 to 1970. They don't list the exact year in the listing. I actually follow this listing. They think it's a 54. P90, pick guard, no cutaway, full size with the tune-o-matic on a floating wood bridge for $1,755.
Oh, that's better than I expected you to...
Yeah.
To say, I mean, over here, obviously, Gibsons are always going to be a little bit more expensive. Right. As soon as a vintage Gibsons had to come across the pond, you know, manually, not via a distributor. Looks like there is, I've got a 1950 to 1970, £2,300 is the 125, no cutaway, single P90 in the neck. That seems to be the most affordable model, 2300. Most expensive is in fact exactly your spec in the UK at the moment. Same finish. Oh no, it's the TCD. So it's a thin line version. That's £4,000 down from £4,650. It's just had a price drop, dear listener. But
yeah, the thin line would be cool, but I really fell in love with the full bodied, ES 175 style. There is one like mine on Reverb right now in Las Vegas. It has the darker burst on the edges like I like, and it is a 68, so you're not going to get the Brazilian rosewood on it because by then it had been shut down. And it is $4,900 plus $100 shipping. I did not pay that much, listeners.
$4,900 still seems like an okay price for a 60s Gibson.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So if you really just want that vintage vibe, and me being a blues player and a wannabe jazz player, 50s Gibsons they're really great. They're really, really, really great. No neck break, no nothing. Serial numbers intact and perfect. The binding hasn't shrunk and cracked like so many of them do. I don't know. I could not have asked for a better guitar for the price I paid.
Right. Yeah. I think you've lucked out there. It is very good. So what does that add to the Gibson collection now? I'm only going on what's behind you. So the Junior, the Les Paul.
So I have this. This is my only vintage Gibson.
Right.
It may be the only vintage Gibson I ever own. We'll see. I can't tell you what the years hold. I would have never thought I owned a 60s Gibson, to be honest. I would have never told you I'd own one. So I have the 125. I have a 58 reissue Les Paul, a 58 reissue 335. I have a Junior. I have an SG Special, non-faded, one of the gloss finishes. Like, you know, they were like used for like $400-500 back in the 2000s. Such a wonderful 2000s.
Guitar. Yeah, brilliant guitar. Great modding platform. One of the only guitars Matt Knight's kept hold of for, the last decade. Brilliant.
And I've put it through hell. It's the only Gibson I've ever had with a cracked headstock, and I did it. It was my fault.
Right.
It actually is no fault of the guitars. I had it in a case where the heads in a bad case. It was not a good case for it because the headstock actually touched the back of the case. It took a fall and it wasn't good. If it had been suspended the way they should be, it would have been fine. I also have the two guitars that were my only guitars for a long time, an ES 135 and an ES 137 custom. So I already know I love that single cutaway Florentine thing.
Yeah. Those are two really pretty obscure hollow body Gibsons
and I got them before the prices went bonkers like they are now. People want $2,200-$2,300 for an ES 135. Now I'm like, do not do that. Do not pay that price for one of those. They're great, but they're not worth it. I blame, I just almost said the wrong name, lead singer, Green Day.
Billy Joe Armstrong.
Yes, thank you. Billy Joe Armstrong had a signature one at one point, and so I think he drove the value of them up a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think he ever played one live, but he did have a signature model.
He did.
Wow. Well, another, because we're going to talk about some other guitars that we both got on order, but another a brand of guitar that both of us own, Grez guitars, Barry Gresbick, Grez guitars. I mentioned a little while ago on the podcast about last year where Barry had briefed Matt and I on the podcast to spec up what a Grez Bass 6 would look like, and he said he'd build one. Well, a few weeks ago, Grez Guitars launched their Grez Bass 6. It was super cool, very much in the style of Grez, so it's always that. What's the name of the wood? What do you call
redwood.
The top?
Redwood.
American redwood top, which is the whole Grez thing. A pair of humbuckers, the classic 30-inch scale that you get on a Bass 6. They come strung with labella flats.
As it should.
Yeah, exactly. It's brilliant. And he developed this interesting tone pot idea to do something similar to the Bass 6, which I'll come on to in a minute. But he did also spec up the Nerds one, and he told me about it and was like, I could offer this as at a discount to your listeners. Maybe we could do something like that. And instead, I just offered to – maybe he could offer that discount to me and purchase. So I did Yes. just buy the Gray. So it will be my second one. So that is currently – it's either on the water or it is in British customs at the moment, working its way slowly to me. I'm very excited. Barry put a picture up of this on his social, on Gray's mm-hmm. Guitars, on Instagram, or you can – he also put a post up on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook. So it's a custom spec Mendocino Bass 6 with a Lola Charlie Christian in the neck, a Halon bit bridge, the Grez aluminium stop tail piece, and it's a black top. It's a gorgeous black top finish, but with still the redwood back and sides and this lovely thick white binding. It's absolutely gorgeous, but really one of the things that makes it incredibly cool is his multi-tone pot, which yeah. is really interesting. So the way a Bass 6 works, dear listener, is you've got on a normal like Fender Bass 6, is you have literally just a on-off toggle for each of the three pickups. And then the fourth toggle is a bass cut. That's great if you're going through a guitar amp, you're going to want the bass cut, you know, or if you want it to use it as a baritone, you want that bass cut. But you get this whole full range thing with all this lovely low end, which you're going to want if you're running through a bass amp or if you're just using it as a bass guitar. And Barry came up with this great different way of achieving that with this multi-tone pot, which allows you to basically boost the bass or sort of cut it and boost treble on a notched rotary rather than it just being you're either or, you're in bass or you're in guitar. So the fact that you've got that pot plus just that one Charlie Christian in the neck position, it means you've got all your tones available to you on that single pot rather than changing pickups, rather than having an all or nothing bass pot. I love the idea of just the simplicity of that. I mean, that was something that like I always loved about when the guitarist in my band, Tim, when he had his Fidelity made, when he had like his custom Fidelity made, and he just went for a P90 in the bridge, and then he just had a volume control and a tone toggle. So it just made it fully, fully rolled off or fully rolled on. And
right.
he had that instead of having a neck pickup because he was like, well, all the people want pickups in different positions, but that's weight and everything else and price as well.
Sometimes it's one more thing to think about while you're playing.
Right. Yeah, sure. Of course. And that's always something he's been very big on. He was like, I don't get it. You do everything with one pickup. You just have it in the position that you want. And then you have a tone control that can change that. And I love that. That's almost, I get to bring this across a little bit in my Bass 6.
Yeah.
Albeit with a pickup in the neck instead of the bridge like his Fidelity is. And it's the gorgeous Charlie Christian pickup. This bass looks absolutely wicked.
I think it looks super, super classy. I will correct you on one thing only because I know because I talk to Barry a lot. Barry is also a sponsor of the 40 Watt podcast. So we talk a bunch. Hopefully we have – I've been waiting on him to finish the Bass 6 because I have another project I'm working on with him whenever we get around to it. But – he uses redwood, he used reclaimed redwood because redwood is a protected species. So you can't actually cut down redwoods anymore.
Of course.
So he doesn't actually use it for the back and sides. He uses it just for the top because right. It's got a very similar tonal response to like, spruce and cedar and the stuff that you use for acoustic guitars. And you know, cause with your Mendocino, the thing I love about his backs and sides and his necks, they're Honduran mahogany, which is very common. You know, we're used to that. But he posted a picture a couple of years ago on his Instagram, and it was the first time I realized it. That back and sides are one piece. He takes a slab and carves it out. there's not pieced together. Yeah. It's not, you know, oh, these sides and then the back. And it's one piece of Honduran mahogany that he hollows out to create. It's absolutely impeccable craftsmanship. And now he's making his own stop tail on these base sixes. He crafts that little piece of aluminum. I think it's aluminum, but yeah. I don't know. I think he's making some of the coolest stuff, and people are sleeping on him and really, really shouldn't.
Guitar Nerds is sponsored by iZotope and Native Instruments, two companies who provide the bulk of the recording and editing tools used by Guitar Nerds. If you have a home studio, or if you're thinking about getting into demo recording from home, then iZotope and Native Instruments provide the tools that you need to make premium quality recordings with ease and with virtually no equipment other than your guitar and laptop. iZotope make all the voice editing and audio repair tools that I use for the podcast each week, and Native Instruments Guitar Rig 7 is one of the best, most comprehensive collections of virtual effects and guitar amplifiers available anywhere. Use discount code NERDS10 on any product in the iZotope and Native Instruments catalog for 10% off their fantastic range of tools. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, most people who have a guitar podcast own a Grez, and
as they should. Yeah. I own two. You're going to own two.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, exactly. Blake's got one, and he's got the baritone. Is yours a baritone? I can't remember.
Mine's a baritone, and it's in black sparkle. It's a beautiful, beautiful instrument. I need to right now it's strung with 13.5 string joys. I am thinking about putting flats on there just to see what it sounds like.
Very, very cool. Yeah, flats are great. I have a set of Stringjoy 13 round wounds that I'm intending to put on my Grez Mendocino standard at the moment. It does have 12s flat rounds on there at the moment, which we're actually going to listen to in a minute, because before we talk about your other purchase, I did want to talk a little bit about the KMA Endgame, dear listener, which is... when I was speaking to KMA about what do you call this pedal in like a sentence, because it's called a duality calibrator, which is not a thing, you know, no one knows what that means. And it's got so many features on it, but there's not like one lead feature. It does so many different things. So it's difficult to say what it is in a single sentence, because essentially what it is, dear listener, is a stereo cab sim. So it has like cab IRs loaded on it. It has sort of user banks that you can add there for your own, but then it has sort of, you know, vintage 30s greenbacks, you know, the sort of standard things that you want. So very useful cab sim with stereo out. So great for creating a stereo rig without having to lug two amplifiers along. And then it has a stereo effects loop, which is great if you want to load any stereo pedals that you can then control via the foot switch. So delays, reverbs, that sort of thing that you can plumb into the stereo effects loop and still get that big wide sound, still going through the cab sims that you want. And then it also has a doubler, which they're calling the TDT. It's a true stereo doubler is basically the gist of it. And it is, you know how a doubler can just sound like a tight delay?
Yeah, yeah.
This has loads more going on. The DSP that they've used to create the doubler means that it's not just doing a slight delay, it's also doing a little bit of a pitch thing and just a whole bunch of things all together to make it really genuinely sound like you've got two guitars playing at once. And then you have a width control for that and an ambience control as well, so you can make it sound very, very ambient and wide or tight and focused, which is what you might need if it's like a big driven rock and roll riff and you just want to hit in a sort of second imaginary guitarist. So those are kind of all the things that it does.
The name is appropriate, Endgame, though, because Duality Calibrator sounds like something Tony Stark came up with to battle Thanos. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, KMA love that sort of thing. All of their pedals always have like a tagline that doesn't really say what the thing is. It's never like, this is a fuzz. It's always like, this is a destruction combobulator. You know, that's not one of them. But you know what I mean. You get the thing. That's kind of
it will be soon, though, coming in late, you know, fourth quarter 2025.
The KMA Destruction Combobulator. That's actually a great name for a pedal.
I think it's great. I'm going to steal it. I'm working on a pedal, so.
Well, there you go. Destruction Combobulator can be there. But anyway, so the sound sample this week, I want to show off the end game. So I'm playing the Grez Mendocino loaded with flats. And what I'm going to do in this demo, is run the pedal through just on its own. So it's just, I ran the ACS-1, the Walrus Audio. That was my main amp model running into the end game. And then I ran the Keeley Halo. I couldn't remember what pedal I plugged in. I'm a big fan of the Keeley Halo, so I had that in the effects loop. So first run through of the progression, you're just listening to basically the ACS running out into the stereo cab sim. Then I'm going to engage the effects loop after that, so you'll hear the delay, the delays come in, still stereo. And then lastly, I will hit the doubler, and so you'll get some of that width. Now, you're really going to hear this properly on headphones, dear listener. Yeah. That's sort of the nature of that style effect. If you're listening to this on a phone, a car stereo, or even sort of speakers that are quite close together, the doubler will be too subtle for you to really get the gist of what this can do. But listen on headphones if you can. I'm going to play the demo now, and we'll have a bit of a chat about it afterwards. Here we go. So there it was, dear listener, the end game Duality Calibrator. I realized I'm pretty sure on these calls, Philip, that it sums to mono for you. So I don't know how much you got the stereo experience there.
Well, I will tell you, it sounded great regardless. Joe, you really are incredibly talented at demoing things in a way that's so different from like the typical like YouTube demoer. Like I am dumbstruck by some of the demos. Like, that was so chill and so different from what I normally think of you musically. And just, that was beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very nice of you to say. Honestly, it's just because I can't really play guitar that well. And so I have to find these little niches of, honestly, you know, like I am an absolute bass player first and foremost. I am one of the least suited people to have the job role that I do in demoing gear for several brands.
There are a lot of guitar players out there right now that are pissed off that you said I'm not really a guitar player and you played that piece. I think you have a disproportionate idea of the talent level. I'm sorry, listeners, I'm just being real, of the average guitar player.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Take that compliment. So that's the end game. I hope you got a good idea for that, dear listener, if you were listening on headphones. It's such a being able to have access to the idea of like a stereo rig, a big washy stereo. I understand that it can be used for, you know, doubling up drive riffs as well. Certainly when KMA did their launch video for the end game, the demo that they constructed for it was kind of a metal piece. It was very much demonstrating how great this is for creating huge crushing guitar tones. And I get that that is a feature that is very, very usable for the end game. But I think for the ambient guitar player, having something like this with the doubler, with the width control, just allows you to... And I didn't really go crazy on the Halo enough to explore just how ethereal the... Well, I mean, the end game's just widening it, but that's incredibly useful for that sort of thing.
I think it sounds phenomenal. Honestly, just being real, I didn't get very excited about the end game when it came out because it's sure. it's a utility thing.
It's a utility and pedal. It's hard to get excited about utility pedals.
It's hard, but I see a legitimate place for it in a lot of rigs, not mine, because it's not something for me. But I see a lot of people who live and die by this amps are dead, I go direct kind of world. I refuse. You can take my amps from my cold, dead fingers after they have crushed me to death, inevitably, from too many of them in my house. Right. But
yes,
but I think it sounds great.
Yeah, it's great. It's a really cool product. It's got a very specific application, but it's if you are looking to, I just think ambient guitarists, this is a real sort of must have for the end of your pedal train to just create something a little bit broader and with more depth and just adding a bit of creativity. It's very cool indeed. Now back to guitars. We talk about guitars, unless you want to talk about any pedal purchases you've made. I was kind of thinking you've got on order something that you sent to me earlier, which I'm itching to talk about.
So it is something that I've had sort of brewing for a little while, and I can tell that whole story. But this is where I'm going to say, because I have opinions. I'm looking at the spreadsheet, listeners, that Joe sends that has all the things to talk about. It's a regular smorgasbord of things to talk about. I want to make sure we hit on the question of the week. So you tell me if we're going to hit that on the Patreon or if we want to handle that here.
I guess we could talk about the question of the week here, just because, you know, we've covered a few purchases on this podcast. Yeah. And maybe we can make the Patreon episode a little hidden mystery. You and I are going to definitely have to talk about one of your other new purchases that's on.
Oh, definitely. I want to talk about all the purchases where people can judge me later on the Patreon. So when there's fewer people listening, we'll talk about all the overspending on gear I've done.
Right, right. Okay, brilliant. Yeah, that sounds like an excellent idea. Okay, well, in that case, Philip and dear listener, we'll talk about the question of the week, which I haven't this week taken from the Guitar Nerds Facebook group. There were actually loads of great discussion points. Some of them I have listed for the future. But I actually wanted this week your help, Philip, and your help, dear listener, on a question that I have from my guitar player, Tim. He turned up at practice this week, and I noticed a couple of things were different. Two really essential things were different. One, he'd taken off his Keeley SY1, which I would consider his tone. Like that
is a dramatic decision too, if that's what you do.
That is the backbone of his sound, because really what it actually is it's not a synth pedal. It's it's an octave up fuzz with a filter on the front. So almost like an auto-wiring octave up fuzz. But he doesn't really use that the filter side of it very much. So it's think of it as an octave up fuzz, but it's very much a real backbone of his tone. And he says it's not working properly. It keeps, you know, not actually giving him the volume that he needs. But
oh, sure.
I think he's probably put it in the wrong place in the pedal chain. Is trying to power it with 6 volts or something. I mean, the guy is an idiot. Like, tonally a genius, but doesn't understand gear at all. So I am going to try and repair it, but let's imagine that he's correct. So he said these two pedals aren't working. One was his SY1, and the other was his drive pedal. Now, he has been using the KMA Logan, which is just a fantastic drive pedal. The downside for Tim with the KMA Logan is it has soft touch buttons, and just the way he stomps around a pedal board, he really needs something that clicks.
Okay, that's good to know, because two of my suggestions, one has soft touch, one doesn't. So
okay. So what the Logan is, dear listener, is a modded Tube Screamer style thing. We're talking about a mid gain drive pedal. And what he came to practice with in place was he had the Redbeard, the Angry Rhubarb in place of the SY1, which he thought he could replace that octave up fuzz with a really sort of trebly overdrive, just a really cutting, biting overdrive. And it didn't have the thickness, it missed that octave up. It, as great a pedal as it is, an absolutely fantastic pedal, it's, you know, he needs an octave up fuzz to replace it. And he had the Walrus Audio 385 preamp overdrive in place of the Logan, which is not a mid-pushed overdrive. It has bass and treble controls. It's gorgeous, transparent sounding overdrive. I love it. But one thing it absolutely isn't is mid-pronounced. So neither tones were right for him. And he was like, oh, well, these are the things that I have. So, you know, what else can I get? So I need to come back to him with some suggestions for a great octave up fuzz and a great mid-pushed drive pedal.
So there's a lot of variations of mid-pushed. So, you know, there's Tube Screamer, there's Klon, there's a lot of versions of mid-pushed. So I have a few things. Actually, I was telling you before we started recording that my whole studio space here is a minefield of guitar pedals, because yeah. I've been going through. I bought one of those Fender boards that we talked about, and because it was on consignment at my local shop for like 30% off, because a guy got it as a gift and he doesn't use pedals. So he just took it to the consignment shop right away and put it on consignment because he was never going to use it. So
amazing.
So I'm putting together a pedal board. So let's talk first about the octave fuzz, because I'm going to recommend my favorite octave fuzz. I have two suggestions. I'm going to give you my favorite one first. And there's going to be a little bit of shilling here, because I have friends who make these things, and I think the best, no fuss, great sounding octave fuzz, and Robin Ford agrees with me out there, is the Mythos Argo.
Right. And so, a brand that I don't think I've ever played anything of, and everyone, your side of the pond, absolutely loves this brand. I need to rectify this,
you
this
do.
Issue.
And they're all over your side too, because Mick over at that sure, pedal show, this is what he uses. Chris Buck uses a bunch of Mythos pedals. So the Argo is based on the old clean octave blend fuzz overdrive. So it has volume, fuzz, and blend to bring in that octave. It's my favorite octave fuzz. It's just dead freaking simple and just sounds incredible. It doesn't care where it is in your chain as much as some.
Yeah, that's important.
So yeah. That's a thing that Zach does over at Mythos. It's my favorite octave fuzz. I highly recommend that to everyone. But because Tim also does weird things, and he's not, you know, I'm going to recommend an EU company as well, in the Mastro Valvola. Let's
see if I can get that to focus. Yes, yeah.
The Off One. It is an octave fuzz with a filter and an expression control to control the filter.
This actually sounds, I mean, I really want to get a Mythos pedal to try it, but this sounds very, very much like absolutely the sort of ridiculous, weird thing that Tim would like.
It's got octave up. It has a mid switch. I can't even understand all the controls. I use it on synth.
Right.
The handful of times I play synth. My favorite thing, though, is with the filter, you can attach an expression pedal to it and sweep through the filter manually to do whatever you want to do. And it almost can pseudo do like a wah octave fuzz hybrid. It's really, really rad. The first time I plugged it in was at a little shop in Nashville called Caldwell Guitars. A buddy of mine, Silas, he's been on the podcast, has that shop. It also does sub octaves as well. It's got two. It's got one octave down and two octaves down. And you can dial those out. If you just want the up octave, you can dial out the sub octave. Right. I plugged this in, started playing. We attached the expression pedal, and I giggled like a school child for 30 minutes playing this pedal. It is absolutely bonkers fun. So I'm going to recommend those two for the octave fuzz. If you want dead simple,
get the Mythos. What was the brand for the second
one? That is Mastro Valvola. It's an Italian company.
Yes.
And it's the off one, OFF one, which is octave fuzz filter one. So
I see,
or it could be octave filter fuzz one. I don't know. It's one of those two. So check those out. Then I'm going to recommend a couple of things. When you said mid pushed overdrive, I have what I think is the ultimate Strat overdrive pedal, but it has soft switches. So I'm going to recommend it. I'm going to recommend it. It's the Wampler Paisley Deluxe. It is the ultimate Strat overdrive.
Right.
Because it just sounds amazing. It's mid-pushed. I can't use it with P90s. So maybe other people can. I can't. I play P90s most of the time or humbuckers. It's a little too mid-pushed for that. But if you're playing single coils, this is your overdrive. But it's got soft switches. So I'm going to back up. I'm going to give you two other options then. Another one, I'm going to go back to Mythos. And it's the new one that they just put out, the Herculean Deluxe.
This looks fantastic. I listened to this a lot when this pedal came out, and yeah, it sounds great. That is a very cool pedal.
Yeah. So
What's the second switch? It's a boost.
So it's got two different topologies inside of it. One is Zach's Herculean, which is my favorite overdrive he ever made, but he discontinued it because it just didn't sell.
Right.
I have the D style one, so it's got like Dumble style aesthetics, and it's meant to tweak to be a little more like a Dumble overdrive. It's got some mid push to it. And then the other side is a Blues Breaker. That's oversimplifying it, but it's basically a Blues Breaker and then a mid push drive on the other.
Wow, that is that's very cool.
So I highly recommend that one. I love this pedal. It's going on a pedal board that I'm building. In fact, this board, I'm going to build a small board for little things when I don't want like the complicated with the MIDI and the other stuff. That it's probably pretty much just going to be Mythos pedals because I think Zach is making some of the best pedals out there. But another one, and this is a shill because this is another sponsor of the podcast. But I'm going to recommend the Summer School Electronics Science Fair.
Right.
So the Science Fair is, it's a dual drive that isn't. So there are two circuits in this pedal. And I'm going to hold this up so that you can see it, Joe. It's one side is essentially a rat circuit. And the other side is a tube screamer circuit. And then there is a master volume and a blend to blend between the two and a single foot switch. So it's one effect. You can go all tube screamer, you can go all rat, or you can find a happy in between them.
That is very cool. That is two great pedals to have side by side that you don't often see. Like, it's normally a rat and a big muff if people put the rat in with something else.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. And I love the fact that it's a single foot switch. It's not a one going into another. It's not anything like that. It's a blend between them. Right. So you get a lot of, I don't know, I've gotten some great, great tones out of it. I've been trying to make a video out of it, but I've been so busy this year, I haven't made a video yet. But Mark over at Summer School Electronics is making some really, really cool stuff.
Yeah, that is very cool. I'm just adding that to my little list of things to suggest to Tim. Yeah, I love those. Those are brilliant ideas. I'm interested in yours as well, dear listener. Let us know. You know, message us. You can DM us on Instagram, or we'll start a little thread about it on the Facebook group, on the Guitar Nerds group. So let me know. Give me some ideas. Things. I was like looking at things that I have lying around that I can give him, and I was like, relatively few mid-pushed overdrives kind of kicking around. Oh, no, sorry, I'll correct that. Relatively few mid-pushed overdrives that I'm willing to give to Tim.
There you go. That's it.
I was thinking about the Boss SY200. I know it's not an octave fuzz, but it's there's such a lot to it. I'm sure he can make some interesting sounds out of that. There's the KMA Mandrake, which is an octave fuzz that can do a very synth-like thing. I've got one of those. They're very cool. And then I was thinking also just – and the reason the SY200 came into my mind is because it's a pedal that I got and then could never really – did anything I wanted.
Right.
It's a brilliant pedal, dear list. Obviously fantastic. Just it's so – modern. You know, I couldn't make the sounds that I want with it, but Tim maybe can. And that got me thinking about, well, what pedals do I have that are too crazy for me that maybe he can do something with? And a pedal that permanently sits on my shelf despite being, you know, fantastic is the Earthquake Devices Data Corruptor.
That's so good.
Yeah, great pedal. I tried putting it on my board for bass a number of times, but of course it doesn't have any sort of blend. It's not really geared up for bass. You disappear in the mix as soon as it's on. So as cool as it sounds, I'd have to be the only instrument playing for it to make noise. I think potentially that's something he could make some cool sounds out of. It's just it's one of those pedals that's very all or nothing.
You know what? Now that you mentioned Earthquaker, that's another one that's sort of been, I've been paying attention to it for the first time, so I don't own one, but the Earthquaker Hoof Reaper is a great one. It's got, I'm trying to remember the circuits on either side, but I don't actually remember, but it's got a really great two fuzzes that are independently switchable and an octave that is independently switchable. But it's a big pedal, takes up a lot of real estate, but it's pretty cool from the demos I've heard. I'm going to end up having to get one.
I see. They do an individual one, don't they? Oh, no, that's the Hoofy Hybrid or something like that that they do.
Oh, yeah, I do not know.
Pedal version. But I don't know if that, I don't know what they've removed from that, whether it's the octave or not.
Right. Yeah, I see that, the Hoof Hybrid. I don't know. It looks like it is the, I'm looking, trying to get the knob layout to pull up. Yeah, I don't think that has the octave in it. Yeah. So that is it's a Russian muff inspired. So that's one side of the Hoof Reaper is a muff. Mm-hmm. I think the other side's a tone bender.
Right, I see.
And you can add octave to either one of them or both. I see. Go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very cool. And I do love that brand. I do really love Earthquaker Devices. Still been, I was really annoyed that Earthquake Advice has brought out the Blooms recently, which is, it sounds amazing. It's obviously brilliant. Bass players were using the Blooms for years. The Blooms is fantastic. I've demoed it here on the podcast, and it's just a great pedal. The problem is, I traditionally don't really like any of the Ashdown overdrives they've put out over the years. So ever since I started working with them, I've been pushing them to, you know, make things slightly differently. And they finally did it in the triple shot, like a drive pedal that I really wanted. And that I didn't design it, but I was there sort of to say, well, maybe if this had less gain and this had more, and I kind of got to shape it a little bit. And it's great. And it's on my board. And the Blooms would do the same thing. And I feel bad about taking the Ashdown pedal off now for the Blooms, but I will eventually. It will save real estate. The Ashdown pedal is massive because they've all got to have VUs in them. But
yeah, that's a vibe. I get it.
That's a vibe. That's a thing. Anyway, we are coming up to the end of this week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. As we mentioned, Philip and I are going to head over to patreon.com/guitar nerds, where we're going to talk about more things. Philip obviously has made more purchases and sales and got some really interesting other gear on the way, so we'll talk about that amongst other things. In the meantime, I just want to, before we go, thank all of our top tier Patreon supporters. There are three tiers at which you can support the podcast, and these wonderful people support the podcast at $10 a month. And for that reason, I read their names out at the end of every podcast and say thank you so much for making all of this possible for the last decade for me. So thank you very much to Stefan Carlson, Nicholas Strom, Rocket Rob Patterson, Phil Sadler, Marcus Deluxe, Suresh, Dorsonic Pickups, Anton Fryant, Barry Gresbick, Steve Davis, John Conaway, Yogi the Guitarist, Ty Allen, Kyle Harris, Sean Hughes, Andy Hoffler, Eric Hemmer, Jeffrey Wax, Dan Pilver, Brian Einsler, Dylan Griffiths, Mark Hizau Kadawaki, Eric File, Peter Peche, Chris Franklin, Andy Manley, Joe Puttick, Blake Weiland, Phil Radomski, Dave Lee, Ross Edwards, Jason Warden, James Dorr, Jake Gray, Derek Rich, Scott Kennedy, Stephen Merkel, Abe Matthews, Christopher Loseth, Stephen Burke, Robin Smith, Kytopia the Band, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Rob Nordvik, Scott O'Brien, and of course, Moog Gravitt. Whew. There you go. That's
there you have it.
Those are all of our lovely Patreon backers. So yes, Philip and I are going to head over to Patreon now, talk about a bunch of other stuff. If you don't already listen to the 40 Watt podcast, what are you doing with yourself, dear listener? It's the other great guitar podcast out there.
It's no number one guitar podcast, but it is there. If you could, y'all go follow on YouTube, as I'm going to be trying to do more YouTube stuff, trying to grow that channel.
That'd be really exciting. I'd be really interested to see more YouTube stuff from you. Just, I think you've got a really interesting, unique collection of guitars and amps, and I want to see them being made loud noises with. But yes, dear listener, do join us over on Patreon, and we'll be back next week with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Au revoir.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.